Welcome to this virtual event on Free Speech Under Fire, How Gender Ideology Threatens Free Speech. My name is Brett Nolan. I'm a senior attorney at the Institute for Free Speech, and I'm happy to be moderating an excellent panel of guests here to talk about an interesting issue, but also a really important issue that deals with several topics that have kind of gripped our nation in more recent years. To get started, I'm going to give a short introduction of our guests, and then I'm going to turn to each of them to share some opening thoughts about our topic, which again is how recent trends in gender ideology and the trans movement are threatening free speech rights around the country. Our first guest is Glenna Goldis. Glenna is an attorney and gay rights activist in New York. She is the founder of the Gender Critical Law Society and the publisher of Bad Facts, a newsletter about the trans legal movement. We also have Kara Dansky. Kara is the former president and current member of the board of directors of Women's Declaration International USA. She's the author of two books on sex and gender and the creator of the TERF Report Substack. And then our last panelist is Del Cold. Del is a colleague of mine here at the Institute for Free Speech. He's a senior attorney who litigates cases on behalf of individuals and organizations all over the country to protect and expand the right to political expression. So before we get to our guests, I'm going to set the stage a little bit. The topic, like I said, is how gender ideology threatens free speech rights. And I think that there are a lot of people who might be watching this and might be interested, might be wondering if they're not involved in kind of these issues day to day, what exactly the gender ideology and trans movement have to do with free speech. People are, you know, maybe familiar with the Scrimeti case from the Supreme Court last year, where the court addressed this issue of states regulating surgeries and medical procedures on kids who suffer from gender dysphoria. And people are probably even more aware of all the controversy about trans athletes, where you have male swimmers or soccer players competing in women's sports because they self-identify as women. But a lot of people might not be familiar with and wondering, what does the First Amendment have to do with any of this? Why are we talking about free speech? And why would anyone think that gender ideology or the trans movement poses a threat to speech rights? I don't think that when you had the civil rights movement from the mid-20th century or the gay rights movement from the last 15 or 20 years, that people were talking about those social movements as a threat to our free speech rights. And so I want to start with that background and turn to you, Glenna, and I want to ask you to maybe give us some background on these issues about gender ideology, the trans movement, and how you see or how we should be thinking about this in terms of speech and the First Amendment.
Thanks, Brett, for that introduction. Yeah, I think that people don't understand how important language is to the trans movement, because we've all been taught that transgender identity is mostly about biology and science and medicine. So you mentioned the Scrimeti hearings. That was a big case about gender medicine for kids. And so we're told over and over again, this is a physical issue. And then the language stuff like pronouns, that supposedly just trails along after the science and the medicine. So the doctor diagnoses you as having a female gender identity, therefore it's proper to call you she, her, and female. But it's actually just the opposite. There's no biological basis for transgender identity. The lawyers are not arguing for rights based on any physical attribute. What is central is language. The idea that you are what you say you are. That is what the ACLU and Lambda Legal fight for in court. So we're in the world of language, and then the hormones and the surgeries, just like clothing, are all just there to, quote, affirm that identity, which is really just words. So language is central. And I think I can bring that to life by using an example. So one type of transgender identity, according to the advocates, is non-binary. So non-binary in this scheme means neither male nor female. And so you can call yourself non-binary, and typically these people will prefer to be referred to as they, them, as pronouns. So for that person, a lot of times they don't medicalize in any way. This is all about how people refer to them. And so if you have somebody who is, say, a woman with short hair, like myself, who thinks of herself as non-binary and not being female, then she wants everyone to call her they them, because that's what keeps the identity alive. Because everyone's going to forget that she's not female if they're just, looking, if you're looking at me, I have short hair, but I'm a woman, you can hear it. You're not going to like get confused and suddenly, people know. So the way the identity is kind of fueled and it makes people comfortable, whatever, however you want to put it, is by having everyone use the proper terminology. And if you don't have people calling the woman they them, then they forget and it kind of all falls apart. So that, and it's the same thing for cross-sex identity as well. But there you have some added attributes of hormones going on. But from a legal perspective, from the perspective of the advocates who want certain rights, it's all the same. It's fundamentally about language, whether it's non-binary or cross-sex. So that importance is why we see such intense efforts to regulate speech all around America, by these activists, some of whom get into power and have government positions. So to make that concrete, the places where this becomes a First Amendment issue are public schools, any public body where you have people giving testimony to the government, so whether it's a state legislature or a school board, and then you can also see it in government workplaces. So these are like the big ones where the issue arises and it's a First Amendment question. And the types of speech that cause these controversies, I put them into three big buckets. So one, as I've been saying, is pronouns. You have, for example, kids being told you have to use the pronoun of your classmates that they want you to use. Number two would be discussions of sex, sexual orientation, or so-called gender identity. So if somebody is just in a classroom or in their office saying, I believe there are two sexes and they're immutable, then that is sometimes censored. And so it's just a discussion of the topic. And we've also seen somebody get in trouble for saying that sexual orientation is about sex, not gender. So we Kara and I know somebody who's a lesbian who said, I'm attracted to the female sex, not to a female gender, like just some like a man in a dress, and that was caused big problems for her. So the third bucket of speech that we're talking about is protests related to gender identity rules. So especially in the sports context, and I know you guys are very familiar with this, you have all across America, you have these girls' sports teams where males are being placed on them because the male identify as female. People want to protest against that because of the unfair advantage, and then public school administrators clamp down on them and say, you're not allowed to say that. You're not allowed to talk about it. So that's another form of censorship and sometimes compelled speech.
Thank you, Glenna. I'm going to turn to Kara now. When Glenna's talking about, censorship from the government and compelled speech and what that kind of looks like in different contexts. And I know that you have some experience, dealing with free speech issues with related to this topic, some really close and personal experience. So I'm going to ask you if you can share a little bit about, what that experience was and how that sort of has maybe shaped some of your views on these issues.
Sure, thank you so much. Glenna mentioned that one context in which this arises is government employment, and that certainly applies to me. So I need to say at the outset that I am not by any means a First Amendment expert, but I do have a personal experience that is very pertinent to this topic. I also need to say at the outset that Glenna and I do not hold back when it comes to using language, to describe sex and so-called gender identity. I think that quote unquote transgender exists only insofar as people use the word to describe themselves. It's otherwise not grounded in material reality. I know that all human beings are either female or male, and saying this out loud has gotten me into a bit of trouble. So I graduated from law school in 1999 and spent nearly 20 years in the field of criminal law and criminal justice reform. I've been a public defender, the executive director of a criminal justice center at a prestigious law school, and senior counsel at the ACLU Center for Justice. I had a brief stint at the Department of Homeland Security's Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties, and another brief stint at the New York Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice. My career would come crashing down in 2019 because of public statements I had made about so-called gender identity, or if you prefer, trans. In 2015, two things happened that are relevant to this discussion. One is that I left the Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice in New York, and the other is that I joined the board of an organization called Women's Liberation Front, which is a radical feminist organization that seeks to abolish gender, of which so-called gender identity is one form. I joined the board of that organization in 2016 and stayed until 2020. Between 2015 and 2018, my life basically went along parallel tracks. To pay the bills, I was doing consulting work with various so-called progressive criminal justice reform groups. I made a legislative action plan for the Brooklyn Defenders Service, wrote a report on drug decriminalization for the Drug Policy Alliance, and worked with the movement to replace Rikers. One project I worked on involved the intersection of criminal and immigration law at the southern border. It was a great project, and I enjoyed working on it. With Wolf, I was speaking out publicly about trans in a voluntary capacity. In 2016, President Obama issued guidance ordering schools all across the country to define the word sex to include so-called gender identity for all Title IX purposes. This would have meant the end of female-only sports and spaces in all of our nation's schools. Wolf sued the administration, and I was invited to go on Tucker Carlson to discuss the lawsuit. And I did. To be clear, I would have preferred to have gone on nearly any other media outlet, but that's the one that invited me. The mainstream legacy media will not touch this issue, although that's starting to change, but that's a different topic. That appearance on Tucker was one of many public statements I would go on to make about the importance of protecting female-only spaces. Shortly after going on Tucker to discuss the importance of female-only sports and spaces, my contractor on the border project called me up and told me that she had to take me off the project. The reason that she gave is that the ACLU of Texas had told her that my presence on the project was toxic because I was a TERF, which originally stood for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist, and we can talk about that more if you'd like. That was the first time I lost employment because I spoke out on behalf of women and girls as a sex class, but it would not be the last. In 2018, I got a job at the Washington, D.C. Sentencing Commission. It's a city agency whose job it is to set criminal sentencing policy in D.C., and I was its general counsel. In early 2019, I was on a panel at the Heritage Foundation titled The Inequality of the Equality Act: Concerns from the Left. I had taken paid leave to attend the event, so I was on non-work hours. Shortly thereafter, someone posted what we then called a tweet, complaining that there was a TERF working at the agency and tagging a member of the DC City Council. As things would have it, my boss had to go before the City Council that very day to defend the agency's budget. After the hearing, that member of council hauled her into his office to berate her about why people were tweeting about me and tagging him. Incidentally, that particular council member was a big fan of gender identity and trans in DC law. My boss had no idea what was going on or what to do. She asked me for a meeting and demanded that I stop talking about this issue publicly. She wasn't a lawyer, but a government administrator. And as her general counsel, I felt compelled to inform her that her demand that I stop speaking publicly probably violated my First Amendment rights because it was a public agency. Over the next several months, several more incidents occurred. People basically kept emailing her to complain about a TERF working at the agency. Every time someone would email her, she would have to share the message with me and we would have to discuss it. This became a complete distraction for her and for me. It distracted us both from the actual work of the agency. And keep in mind, this was a criminal justice agency that had nothing to do with sex or so-called gender identity. I don't think my boss ever particularly wanted to fire me. She just wanted me to shut up about women's rights. She consulted with the chair of the commission, who's a judge. He confirmed that the commission could not constitutionally fire me for statements about an unrelated topic that I had made on my own time during non-work hours. I received a very carefully worded letter notifying me that yes, I have a First Amendment right to make such statements, but that I should be sure to do it only on my own time. That was a perfectly reasonable position for the agency to take, but I also knew that if I continued to speak out, even on my own time, The complaints were not going to stop. I realized I had a choice. I could keep my job and shut up about women's sex-based rights, or I could quit. So I quit. These days, this is all I do. Sometimes I say that I'm a full-time professional unemployed TERF. I don't make much money doing it, but I'm proud of the work. Thank you.
Thank you, Kara. I think that that's there are a lot of things in there that I think we might want to come back to later here. I'm going to go to Dell, and I want to ask you, about your own experience as a free speech lawyer. You're someone who actually litigates these cases on behalf of people like Kara, who have run into the government's censorship efforts. So, could you talk about what that looks like from your perspective and share maybe any broader insight that you have into why this is such an important battleground?
Thanks, Brett. So there are two main cases I've had in the last year, year and a half, having to do with the First Amendment and trans speech related issues. One is probably the most well-known case is the Bo Schools XX wristband case, officially called Fellers v. Kelly, set in Bo, New Hampshire. Some parents were concerned that a biological boy, transgender woman, was playing on the Plymouth High School girls varsity team. They were about to play the Bow High School girls team. A couple of the dads and a mom were concerned about that. There had been, as background, there had been a law passed by the New Hampshire legislature to make it illegal for biological boys to participate, to compete against biological girls, but the ACLU had gone to court and gotten an injunction for two litigants, two biological boys that thought they were girls, including this one boy who was playing on the Plymouth team. So the parents decided to protest quietly by wearing pink wristbands. Ordered on Amazon. They're basically breast cancer awareness wristbands, and they were customized with two black X's, XX, of course, for the female chromosomes, actually a science-based message. And without going into hideous details about what happened at the soccer game on September 17th, 2024, they displayed these wristbands on the sidelines for about 10 minutes. They didn't say anything to anybody. They weren't yelling anything at any of the players on the field. And they were approached by school officials and forced to remove the wristbands. The school had been tipped off by a progressive parent, had a armed police officer there. Actually, it was in body armor. It feels particularly incongruous because Bow, New Hampshire is an incredibly safe community. But the school was there in force. They had police backup. One of the parents actually got sent off from the sidelines, not so much for wearing the wristbands, but for asserting his rights to criticize the Bow officials for not standing up for girls' sports. He called the athletic director a coward, and that really upset him, so he got sent off. Long story short, two of the dads were trespassed from future games. It was made very clear that they could not wear those wristbands at future events. We had a hearing in front of the district court in New Hampshire where there was testimony from the superintendent, Marcy Kelly, that this policy of excluding the XX wristbands from sports events would be enforced at future events, and it would be enforced regardless of whether any transgender player was playing on the field or any transgender student was even present. She said, in contrast, when I asked her cross examination, what about if somebody wore a pride flag shirt? Would that be allowed? She said, probably that would be allowed because it was an inclusive message, but the XX message was exclusive. The Principal Fisk, went even further and said that the XX message is a hateful symbol that is unable to be displayed anywhere on school property. He didn't use the word swastika, but he was essentially likening it to a swastika. So what happened? The district court judge in that case dragged his feet, took months and months and months, and then eventually denied our request for preliminary injunction. Without getting into all the maneuvering, we asked for an injunction for the court to order the officials not to enforce this unconstitutional policy. In other words, to allow the parents to wear these XX wristbands to Bo's sporting events. He denied the injunction. It's a lengthy opinion. I have a lot of problems with the opinion, but one thing that really stood out is he actually went so far as to say that displaying the XX wristband was like directly assaulting the transgender students. So from a free speech perspective, this is just breathtaking. Equating a science-based, passively expressed message to assault. I'm sorry. It's inflammatory, hyperbolic. It is unmoored from criminal law or constitutional law. I spent several years in a prior life as a county prosecutor. I prosecuted plenty of assault cases. None ever involved somebody passively displaying a sociopolitical message. So that's one case that we have going on. Of course, we appealed. Appeal is now pending in front of the First Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals in Boston. I will say not the best court for free speech issues, particularly in the school setting. They have the somewhat notorious LM decision involving student speech in the classroom or the school hallway. But this case is even more concerning because it involves the government censoring adult speech, non-student adult speech, in a limited public forum in a setting that's open basically to all comers. To my pleasant surprise, the panel that we argued in front of on November 5th, just a few weeks ago, seemed troubled by the district court's ruling. They seemed to be trying to find criteria or rules for where they might be able to draw the line. I don't want to get overconfident. I don't want to jinx it, but I am cautiously optimistic that we will get some kind of a positive result, perhaps narrower than we would like. And if not, then we'll certainly be pursuing further appeals in the case. The other case is Gays Against Groomers versus Garcia. I represent two individuals, two organizations in Colorado, a gay man who's a member of Gays Against Groomers, and a straight woman who is a power lifter and a advocate for women's sex-based rights. They were trying to testify in front of the Colorado legislature about a then pending bill called Tiara's Law. Tiara's Law was basically designed to facilitate name changes by transgender individuals in Colorado, and particularly to remove impediments for individuals that had criminal histories. So they named this bill after Tiara. Tiara is a former sex worker who had a criminal history related to that sex work from another state. His real name was Dwayne. I forget his last name. I think he had a couple different names, AKAs, may have been related to his criminal history. But he preferred the name Tiara, and that was also his stage name that he used for his burlesque shows and his drag shows, some of which included minor individuals. So my clients wanted to testify in front of the Judiciary Committee and the Senate Committee and express their concerns about why this was not a good idea. Rich Guggenheim's views were particular. This is setting back the gay rights movement by essentially facilitating access to minors in a way that was not good. Straight female speaker, Christina Gokey, she just wanted to be able to say what a woman is. Again, I won't go into all the details. They were both not allowed to finish their speeches. Rich chose not to give his first speech. And the second speech in front of the Senate, he was repeatedly interrupted and not given his full time. With regard to Christina Gokey, the Colorado legislature went even further. The part of her testimony that had originally been part of the publicly available audio, including her getting interrupted, was simply removed from the record memory hole. And so there's just a kind of a blank gap in the recording. So after sitting on it for a while, the district court in Colorado ruled against us and said that legislative immunity applied. And then also our claims were moot. We appealed that to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver. Again, the oral argument went well. The court seemed to see this as a case where the legislative immunity might not apply. Again, I don't want to jinx it. We don't have an opinion yet, but I'm also cautiously optimistic that we will get some kind of a ruling that is more positive than the one we had below. I think this illustrates some of what Glenna was talking about earlier also, in the sense that the control of language is very important to the transgender movement, and it serves controlling language serves a kind of a legitimating function or legitimizing function to the gender ideology or the transgender ideology, depending on what terminology you want to use to describe it. I'll give you an example. Rich Guggenheim, in his speech before the Senate Judiciary Committee in Denver, talked about his views as a homosexual man, and he attempted to share historical facts about the gay liberation movement from Stonewall in 1969 by discussing two individuals, Malcolm Michaels Jr. and Tony Rivera. They're two long-deceased Black gay male sex workers and drag queens, which Rich believes were often falsely referred to as transgender women, named Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera. Those were their stage names. In Rich's view, and many others hold this view, they are both biological men, gay men, who had a stage persona that meant, was about performing in drag. But to many in the transgender movement, these are, in fact, transgender individuals in their views that were wrongly perceived as gay men. So even mentioning that these are gay men as opposed to, or positing that they're gay men who perform in drag versus being transgender women, that couldn't be said out loud. And claiming these individuals, these historical figures, was, served an important legitimating function. So to protect the feelings of two people who were deceased and weren't there, Rich had his speech censored. And I think it illustrates both what Glenna and Cara talked about the importance of language. It's that important that we have to protect the feelings of people who are dead. All right, I think
It's
that's enough for now.
yes, you're it's probably a good time to see if either of you, any of you all have, some things you'd like to ask each other or follow up on what someone has said. Jump in. If not, I've got some questions I'd like to ask you, but I want to sort of give you all the floor to respond to each other if you have something to say.
I'll just add on to that story about Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson, that the reason why they're so defensive of that story and intolerant of additional context is because they're trying to create the sense that transgender is a coherent and distinct category of human. And when the truth is that people wear opposite sex clothing for all sorts of reasons, and one very common one is like you're gay and either you like to wear gender nonconforming clothes or you're performing in drag. This is very common and people know this, but they're trying to construct a category where there isn't one, honestly. We have these little girls who want to be boys because they like soccer. We have adult men who dress up as women for certain personal reasons that used to remain private. And they're not all the same people, but the movement needs to try to create the sense with language that they are.
I would just add to that another reason they need Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera to be quote unquote transgender women is because the idea that trans women of color started the gay rights movement at Stonewall is absolutely important to them. And it relates to a phenomenon that I refer to as trans washing in one of my books, which is you will see organizations like GLAAD, PFLAG, GLSEN, all these organizations that started out as gay rights organizations today will say, oh, we started in 1975 to advance the rights of LGBTQ plus people. That is absolutely critical to their narrative when really these were gay rights organizations that have essentially now sold out lesbians and gay men. I don't know if Glenna would agree with that, but yeah.
Whenever you talk about language and controlling language, it obviously, Orwell comes to mind, right? The idea about rewriting history and telling, people what words that they can and cannot say, and coming up with new definitions of words that we're all sort of already familiar with. And you have Dell's example of literally erasing the public record because they didn't want to hear what someone had said. I on that kind of a th that point, I'm gonna go to Glenna here and ask her first, and Dell and Carrie, you can weigh in afterwards. I want to ask her about sort of the idea of harassment, and Dell has this case where the court a acted like wearing a wristband was an assault. And before I hear from you, Glenn, I'll just say that I think that there probably is a little bit of a popular sentiment in some ways that, people are comfortable with the idea that the government can prohibit harassment. The government in the school context can prohibit bullying. Dell mentioned earlier this case out of New England, the First Circuit Court of Appeals, where they prevented a student from wearing a shirt that talked about there only being two genders, and there's a discussion in that case about psychological and emotional harm when people are being quote unquote misgendered. And so I'd like you, Glenna, to maybe talk a little bit about this, the concept of misgendering and harassment in general, and why the government shouldn't be able to protect people, or as they say, or students from this kind of speech.
Right. So what we hear the trans advocates do is they draw an analogy between so-called misgendering and hurling racial slurs or sexually harassing somebody. And they cite the case law about those topics and they appeal to people on that level of like this is just garbage talk that has no value. People are only calling you by the opposite, by the pronouns you don't like because they hate you. That's the only reason. And they say the law doesn't give any value to that, just like using the N-word or harassing a girl because of what she looks like. And it's not a good analogy for many reasons. One is that the so-called misgendering is political speech. This is a political topic in our country, and it has to be discussed. We're still working out what the law and policy should be. That's very different from the context of racial slurs or sexual harassment, where there's no political content and there's legal precedent saying these are different. We also have the objectivity versus subjectivity issue. So you can't have every group of people kind of making up new rules about what is too offensive and what cannot be said and just labeling that harassment. That goes against the First Amendment. And I can let you guys talk more about the law, but I think we all know that and this is what gets hard in our liberal circles because I think there's a really knee-jerk tendency to just say, like, look, we're the nice ones. And we're not, if someone tells me this hurts their feelings, then I'm going to respect that because I'm nice and it's the other guys who, don't respect feelings. And you can do that in your personal life, but we cannot have the law operate that way.
Kara, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, but I do think that as someone sort of who has experienced not just the sort of legal aspect of it, you weren't fired from your job, you chose to quit because of this kind of constant pressure. Do you have any thoughts or insight about the sort of the cultural impact of when people are, using pronouns, or they feel compelled to use certain kinds of pronouns because of that social pressure, and how that actually distorts, the thinking about these issues for those who aren't necessarily really engaged?
Yeah, I mean, studies have shown that when people use opposite sex pronouns to describe people, it causes serious cognitive dissonance. There's something called the Stroop effect, which it has nothing to do with this, but talks about how if you are looking at the word red, but the word appears green, that causes cognitive dissonance in our own minds. And the same is true if you read an article, say, in the New York Times about a swimmer named Will Thomas, and it repeatedly refers to him using she, her pronouns, that causes cognitive dissonance in our minds, even though we all know that he's a man. So it's really very troubling. And I guess this is slightly unrelated to the technical First Amendment issues, but I just do want to share that when women speak out about this stuff, we are very frequently met with actual literal violence. So I have been at rallies to speak out about women's sex-based rights, and groups of people, mostly men, but plenty of women, will literally attack us with physical violence. So to be told that using a correct sex pronoun constitutes actual violence or a form of assault is just really insulting to those of us who have been on the receiving end of violence by people who don't think women should talk about this stuff.
This is a question I have to both Cara and Glenna. To what extent is the trans rights movement a men's rights movement?
I mean, my answer is that I don't know to what extent, but it's a combination of a men's rights movement and a complete denial of material reality.
Yeah, if you're going to be cynical about it, the men have things to gain and the women don't. I know that's a condescending to the women who think that they're getting value out of identifying as non-binary or male, but like they're not. But certain guys getting into the women's changing rooms, they are.
I think all of you all, at least I know Glenna and Dell, specifically Dell, talking about some of his cases. And Glenna, in your opening, you sort of talked about these three like buckets of issues, and one of them has to do with schools. And a lot of the examples that you see involve kids, involve schools. I think it's really obvious that the gender ideology movement has really used schools as a tool to kind of push a lot of their views and introduce these ideas into younger generations through the curriculum, through maybe even just displaying signs and flags and just doing different things to support this. On the one hand, for those who are against this kind of ideological movement, there's a real visceral reaction to you're indoctrinating kids. But they're, schools often teach, concepts that are moral and ideological. People don't have the same reaction if a school were to tell kids that, slavery is bad or racism is bad, and schools tell kids that recycling is good or that you shouldn't do drugs. So I want to ask, and I can open this up to sort of any of you all that want to take this on, but how should we think about, the fact that why this issue is really different compared to other issues, and the way in which it affects our kids and our the way schools kind of push these are pushing this ideological message on kids?
I mean,
Well,
I think.
the
Oh, go ahead.
you
Go ahead,
go.
Glenna.
Oh. Well, I mean, at a certain point, you just have to draw a line and say this is false, but and that's why it's bad. But I also think that the nature of it, we're talking about free speech, and this is a subject where kids are not allowed to debate it. So the other thing is, I was kind of a contrarian when I was a kid, and I would argue with like anything the teacher said. I accidentally wound up arguing the Holocaust didn't exist when I was like 9 because I just thought they were indoctrinating us because it sounded too crazy to be true, like. Kids need to be able to debate, and the fact that they're not allowed to argue or debate about trans is a big red flag and bad in and of itself. So, I mean, if teachers were teaching, okay, this viewpoint about trans exists, but also this alternative one exists that there are two sexes, I mean, I would still be concerned, but I'd be so much less concerned because I know that call it the marketplace of ideas, even among 6-year-olds, I think they're going to notice that, oh, yeah, there are two sexes. So the fact that this is completely shutting out the opposite view, I think is what tells us that there's something wrong.
Definitely. And I would also argue my main approach to this comes from the standpoint of feminism, because I care about women and girls as a sex class, but I also care about material reality. And by teaching kids that there aren't two sexes, the sex binary is absolutely foundational to so much of our society. And if we lose that, we're literally losing our hold on material reality. I also just wanted to mention really briefly on the idea of slurs and misgendering and harassment. Probably you all and most of your audience are not a big fan of hate speech laws. We're not supposed to have the very concept of hate speech in the United States, and it's terrifying to see what's happening in other countries. But setting that aside, I am not a fan of men who use misogynistic slurs to describe me. I don't like that. But if a man wants to use a misogynistic slur against me, I can just choose not to like him and I can avoid him. I don't think he should be locked up for it. But when we're dealing with the material reality of sex, we're dealing with something else entirely, which is truth. And we cannot make a statement about truth. Certainly, we can't make it a criminal offense, but I don't think we should be making it a punishable offense under any circumstances.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Cara and Glenna said, also in particular about the importance of truth and being able to debate ideas about something as fundamental as identity and sex. I think, Brett, to get back to your question about why is the trans movement focusing on schools, I think it's because kids are uniquely vulnerable to being parasitized with the trans ideology. Kids are, they have super plastic brains in terms of learning. They're primed to learn. They're also very confused. They're going through puberty and trying to figure out what they who they are and what they like and who they're going to be in the future. And there's a lot of confusion. And I think the trans movement unfortunately takes advantage of that. I know my client Rich Guggenheim, who's a Gays Against Groomers member, he's of the view that a lot of these kids are they're that come to identify as trans or are gay kids that are confused and are preyed on by the trans movement essentially and convinced that they're transgender. What I understand coming out of the studies out of Europe, is that, kids, if they're just left alone, it's a phase. And the vast majority of them will snap out of it. And, unfortunately, in the United States, there's been a very aggressive approach in a lot of areas where they start with the social transition and then that often leads to the medical transition. And that obviously can be irreversible and cause some lasting damage. So, just some additional comments, Brett, but I think that that's one of the reasons why they want to get them young, get them when they're vulnerable.
So one of the things I'm sorry, I can't remember if it was Glenn or Kara that said, but I wrote it down, was that one of the differences between talking about slavery or something, I think this was Glenn, maybe, is that with this issue, what you're seeing happen is that you're not allowed to debate it. And I think that that seems as really obvious that, I kind of posed the question at the beginning of this, why weren't people worried about the civil rights movement or other kinds of movements posing a threat to free speech? And that's probably the crux of a lot of it is what is happening in this movement is that people are using the government to just shut down debate. But I'd like, I guess, to just push on this issue about things like misgendering and harassment, bullying in schools, and just see if you could talk maybe a little bit more about how we should think about the idea that in a school setting, students are using biological pronouns when that really upsets a 12-year-old. Because that 12-year-old has been, told that their gender identity is important and that this is violence against them. How should we think about not wanting to be necessarily, like you said, we want to be respectful of other people. You especially want kids to learn how to be respectful of each other. But there are real dangers in having kids just accept that it makes sense to call someone a boy when they're a girl. How should we think about that conflict, which, you understand the viewpoint of wanting to not allow bullying, but also you want to push back and make sure that truth matters.
Well, the adults are inculcating this anxiety in the kids. When we were in school, nobody was breaking down in tears because they were referred to by their sex pronouns. That did not exist. Nowadays, what's happening is, and you said it, Brett, they're teaching kids that it is violence against them if their pronouns are not respected. First of all, they're being taught in the first place that they might have special pronouns. And this is messing with their heads. They're being encouraged not only to believe something false, but to have thin skin and to believe that they are not resilient. And I don't want to go too much into child development. I'll stick with law. And so I'll go to a seminal case, Tinker v. Des Moines. I think it was like 1969 or so. The Supreme Court looked at the situation in Iowa where some kids were protesting the Vietnam War at school by wearing black armbands. And I believe this was a middle school also, or both middle school and high school. And it was a very fraught issue because, men and young men in the community were in Vietnam, they were dying in Vietnam. There could have been kids in the school whose older brothers were, injured or killed in Vietnam. And so they were justifiably very emotional about this subject. The Supreme Court still declared that no, this has to be allowed because we shouldn't be protecting kids' feelings to the extent that we're shutting down debates. It's good for kids to be exposed to that. And, at a certain point, it's just a choice that we make as a country that we want to be the sort of place where people are not so thin-skinned and they learn from a young age how to debate. And we've seen that in case after case, as you guys know, and in front of the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I mean, I would just add, I think it's really important to understand that there is nothing kind or compassionate about lying to a child and making or allowing a child to believe that he or she actually is the opposite sex. The much kinder thing is to help that child accept him or herself just as he is or she.
Oh, go ahead, Dell.
I was just gonna just to dovetail with what's been said. I think one of my observations as a free speech litigator is a lot of the seminal cases that we rely on in the area of viewpoint discrimination kind of rely on the concept that you can't censor speech because it promotes a minority viewpoint, an outlier viewpoint. Often it's even talked about as being an offensive viewpoint, whether you're talking about Tinker or Cohen v. California or the more recent cases like Brunetti and Tam, which are more patentability cases, but they essentially stand for the proposition that you cannot enshrine the majoritarian view by saying this speech that is offensive to the majority can be censored. That is viewpoint discrimination because having an offensive valence to your speech is a viewpoint, and a viewpoint that is subject to almost absolute protection under the First Amendment. I think what's interesting about trans speech issues is that the views promoted by the trans movement are generally not majoritarian views. We can pick low-hanging fruit. An easy one is trans inclusion in sports or allowing biological males to compete against females because they happen to believe that they're girls. That's an extremely unpopular idea. And it's unpopular across many demographics, including Democratic Party voters. And there are other issues like controlling people's speech and allowing biological men into women's spaces and the like that are extremely unpopular. This sort of flips the usual situation that you see in the seminal for free speech cases, because usually what you see is a majority that says you can't express that minority viewpoint because we find it offensive or maybe uncomfortable, and we're imposing our majoritarian view here. What I'm seeing, at least in my cases in the trans movement, is you have a minority view, often an extreme minority, that's not shared by the majority or by regular people. They are seizing control within institutions and then using state power to propagate their ideology because their ideology is unpopular. So they use the state power and censorship to propagate and protect their ideology. And you see that in school boards, you see it at the Colorado legislature. You know, why not just let Rich Guggenheim and Christina Gokey have their 3 minutes and express their opinions? You don't have to agree with them. What is so dangerous that they can't even say that out loud? So dangerous you have to erase Christina Gokey's comments from the public record. Public record that probably only a few hundred people would ever listen to anyway, you know? So it's an interesting situation, and I think it tells you something about the trans rights movement, that they rely on censorship, and I suspect we're going to see more of it in more cases in this area in the future.
That tees up really well my last question here as we kind of wind down. I think that you're right that an interesting part of this is that on a lot of these topics, it's a minority viewpoint. But that they, for whatever reason, the people who have maybe control of some of the institutional power are able to exert their will on the silent majority. But I think that one of the issues likely is that a lot of because of that dynamic, a lot of people don't necessarily understand that polling suggests that like the majority is overwhelmingly in their favor on these issues, and it can feel day to day for people like that they're a bad person if they think this or say this. And the topic of our talk today is about the threat to free speech, and not necessarily just the threat to the First Amendment. Free speech is as much a cultural issue as it is a legal issue. And, in 25 years, when all of these kids are in the workforce and taking control of government, becoming judges themselves, and they've been sort of taught all of these things about gender ideology, then I'm not sure that the First Amendment can withstand that. So I guess my question for you all, and I'll pitch it to you first, Kara. We've got a few minutes left. Is what can people do, the average person day to day, to push back against some of this cultural power that's being exerted against them?
So I remain a registered Democrat, notwithstanding my intense frustration with my own party leadership on this topic. It's what my second book was about. But I, as you say, a vast majority of rank and file Democrats and former Democrats who have left the party over this issue agree. And so I just want to encourage people, please feel comfortable speaking out to people, to friends and family members. I know it can be hard, but it can be done. I've been doing more and more of that. I have lost a couple friends and family members, but for the most part, that hasn't really happened to me. And then I also want to put out a pitch to lawyers who are litigating these cases to be incredibly precise with language in briefs, because I've seen over and over again, even lawyers who really want to do the right thing and really want to, say, get men and boys out of girls' sports or, protect female-only spaces. A lot of lawyers will often concede that there is a coherent category of people called transgender. And that is incredibly dangerous because we need to get these judges, including a majority of the United States Supreme Court, we need to get these judges to stop thinking along those lines and to think purely about the material reality of sex.
Glenna, do you have any thoughts to add about this?
Yeah, second everything Kara said. And I'll add from a selfish point of view, on top of speaking out yourself, especially people who operate in blue states and liberal areas, whatever it may be nice to the people who are speaking out, like Kara and me. Because I, when I first started talking, I was just really excited to have people who agreed with me behind the scenes. But, when things get dicey, people tend to fade away. And it's like, you guys, we would all, if everybody just, because right now I know everyone's secrets. So I know that like If we could just flip a switch where like everybody said what they, I'm not saying they understand everything about the issue. Like a lot of people still think that there's like 0.01% of the population has the wrong brain and the wrong body or whatever. But generally, like nobody wants the boys and the girls sports. They were when not actually happening, but it is. But anyway, I just, yes, everybody speak out. And then, like, I know some of you won't speak out, but just like be nice to the people who are speaking out. Don't be a jerk about it and say, well, I think you were a little bit rude when you said, just like be cool. Just.
Yeah.
Good advice. Be cool is always good advice.
Yeah. So, my observation is that the transgender rights movement doesn't just rely on coercion, but it's actually quite manipulative. And they leverage this desire to be liked by people. They leverage this desire by, regular, for lack of a better term, bourgeois, middle class folks to be inoffensive, to be polite to people, to refer to people the way they want to be referred, and all that. But it's very insidious because it controls how you speak. It requires you to say things that are untrue. Which I think, lying is itself a problem, but it's also a matter of self-respect for yourself. So I would say some very concrete things that you could do is decline to use people's preferred pronouns. Some people would just try to work around the issue and avoid the topic and not use the language, but I think you're already kind of giving in partly to the ideology and the coercion and the manipulation by doing that. So I would say use accurate pronouns, use accurate terminology, particularly in court briefs. And if you're in an organization, luckily we don't have anything like this at IFS, but there's a lot of pressure on people to include their pronouns in their bios. There may not be explicit policies to that effect, but there may be examples, leaders in the organization doing it. And so decline to do that. If you're asked to do that, decline to do that, because they're asking you to make an ideological political statement and probably one you personally disagree with. Before we wrap up, Brett, I thought maybe it would be great to hear from the experts, Glenna and Cara, just describe what misgendering and dead naming is, because I find that we're so used to this terminology. Like, if a normal person, is not well versed with the topic, watches this video or listens to the podcast, what does this even mean?
Glenna, do you want to take that? I'm going to have to jump off in a few minutes.
Okay, sure. I'm stuck with misgendering. Okay, in the gender ideology, everybody has a gender, whether you say you do or not. Everyone has a gender, which means, and gender is like synonymous with pronouns because pronouns are so important. So if the idea is that if somebody uses pronouns for you that you don't like, they're different from your gender, then that is misgendering. And that is like a cardinal sin. So if you refer to a non-binary person as she, that's misgendering. It's very bad. And dead naming is so people oftentimes, maybe typically, change their names when they decide to we'll call it transition, when they take on a trans identity. And so whatever name they used before that is then referred to as their dead name, and it is verboten. You're not supposed to use people's dead name. You're supposed to pretend that they've always been whatever their new name is.
I think that, we should all, our free speech alarms should always be going off whenever the government is trying to tell us what kinds of words we should use and not use. This has been a great talk. I want to just thank you all on behalf of myself and the Institute for Free Speech for joining us. Hopefully we'll do some more of these events in the future.
That was great. Thank you guys so much for hosting this.
Sounds
Thank
good. Thank
you.
Thank
I
you.
enjoyed it.